Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll look at a number of subjects in the news. We'll begin in a moment and speak with Robert Baer, who was a CIA operations officer that served as the head of the organizing the Iraqi opposition between the Gulf War and the current war. And he wrote a book about Saudi Arabia, Sleeping with the Devil, How Washington Sold Our Soul for Saudi Crude, and more recently, Blow the House Down. He is the character that George Clooney played in the movie Syriana. And as a CIA operations officer, he principally targeted Hezbollah and the Iranian Revolutionary Guards. And, of course, the Iranian Revolutionary Guards are holding 15 British sailors and Marines, perhaps hoping to exchange them for some Iranian National Guardsmen that the United States captured in Erbil a month or so ago. We'll be talking to him about how, in Bob Baer's opinion, the Iranians, particularly the radicals, the Revolutionary Guards, have in fact handed George W. Bush causus belli, the cause for war, to in effect a gift. So exploring that notion that indeed, and it's obvious that the British and the Iranians are talking past each other, so that is a crisis that appears to be unraveling and tension appears to be increasing and the military option appears to be more and more likely. He writes a column for Time.com. We'll also be joined by Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, who was Colin Powell's chief of staff at the State Department during the first 4 years of the Bush administration. He was the first to sort of break ranks, if you will, and talk about the Cheney-Rumsfeld cabal running the country. And he's the Pamela Harriman Visiting Professor of Government at William & Mary College, and he'll be talking to us about both the possibility of war with Iran, what's happening in Iraq, and a possible opening with Syria, where the Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker of the House, is in Israel Sunday, about to visit Syria later, and there's possibly some possible deal that she could make, which indicates that the White House no longer really is conducting foreign policy. They're obviously upset about her trip. It's a repudiation of President Bush's leadership, but increasingly he appears to be coming irrelevant, and we'll explore the notion of the next year and a half or so with not just a lame duck president, but a dead duck president. And we'll also speak with Max Blumenthal, who's a Puffin Foundation writing fellow at the Nation Institute, and he's been covering some interesting stories lately, not the least of which was gate-crashing the conservative convention recently in Washington, the CPAC conference. But the most recent work he's doing is looking into who this woman, Monica Goodling, is, the woman that just refused to testify to the Judiciary Committee Oversight Committees in the House and Senate, invoking the Fifth Amendment. She's a graduate of Messiah College and went to Pat Robinson's law school. So we're getting an inkling on the extent to which the federal bureaucracy has been seeded by young zealots trained by Pat Robinson. And the extent to which it's happened already is quite alarming. Let's now go to the subject of the possibility of a war with Iran. I'm speaking with Robert Baer, the author of Sleeping with the Devil, How We Sold Our Soul for Saudi Arabia, and more recently, Blow the House Down. And you had a piece, your regular contributor to Time.com, Robert Baer, where you suggested that the Iranians have almost gifted President Bush with a causus belli. In his press conference on Saturday, where he was asked, where he demanded that the Iranians return the British sailors and Marines, he didn't answer the question that was asked, if they were Americans that were captured, what would you do? So what's your sense of whether President Bush will take up this gift from the Iranians?
Here's my sense. And that is that this administration, Dick Cheney in particular, because the Iran policy is being run out of his office right now, would like to provoke Iran into a fight, a hot war, if you like. The fact that the Kurds, the Iranian Kurds in the north, are arming, going across the border, we're doing nothing to stop it. The Azeris in the north, who are not Sunnis. They are Sunnis, but they're not Persians, are coming across the border as well. So you've got Iran is in a state of paranoia. It's going to be attacked. And the Iranians, when they become insecure, take hostages. At the same time this is happening, we've got two carriers, two battleship groups in the Gulf, which the Iranians believe is a prelude to an attack. So I think what we're seeing is the Bush administration is feeding Iranian paranoia, hoping that the Iranians will take some American soldiers and that we can respond. The Bush administration will not need to go to Congress at that point, and it'll get the war it wants.
And the other alternative would be just all of that military activity in the Gulf with the Revolutionary Guards. I mean, for a moment, you mentioned that the Kurds, I take it, mean they're crossing the Iranian border.
The Iranian border from Iraq.
And as are the Azeris being stirred up as well. What about, though, the notion that there's a kind of masochism on the part of the Iranian regime, that they're into martyrdom?
Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps is made up largely of a lot of apocalyptic Shia who believe in end times and believe that they're going into a final confrontation with Christianity, the West, the United States, whatever. And it's almost a cult, the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps. And yes, they may want a war. They may have taken the 15 hostages. They're not talking about it. It's difficult to tell what they're doing because we really can't get inside this group, but they are radical, and they are a parallel government in Iran, and the answer to one person is Khamenei, who's clearly at this point behind hostage-taking.
So it was a quid pro quo. Then they grabbed the Brits in exchange for the people the Americans took at Erbil, and of course the British are so vulnerable in Basra militarily. One phone call from Iran, and they can basically they'd be surrounded in a Fort Apache.
They would be completely surrounded. Iran is capable of disrupting our supply lines in the south, either using the Shia or their own forces. I just don't think the administration really cares much. I think that Bush has an agenda for the next year and a half, and that is to take down Iran as well as Saddam Hussein. And the military, you can see, is panicking. I'm in touch with a lot of military officers, and they're telling me that the military in Iraq is breaking as it did in Vietnam.
Well, apparently there's a report earlier that while Cheney was traveling around the country, a number of people who normally don't get to Bush were able to get to him. And apparently Gates delivered that message that if he does go into Iran, a lot of senior military people will resign en masse.
Oh, I think absolutely. You can see this all, people that had supported Rumsfeld and Bush for, 5 years are now abandoning him. They are blogging. They are going out into the press. They're mainly talking to each other. I don't think that Bush cares. I think he thinks he's right.
But what about the Iranians? Don't they think they're right? And are they not resigned?
Have two apocalyptic leaders, Ahmadinejad in Iran and Bush in the White House, which makes for a very dangerous situation.
So when Ahmadinejad says that the reason he didn't come to the United Nations was that he decided that the United States was preparing to attack him at any rate, so what was the point?
I think he believes that. I mean, the United Arab Emirates, Sheikh Zayed has announced that he's not going to support a war on Iran. King Abdullah of Saudi Arabia has condemned the occupation of Iraq, which essentially has cut himself loose from the United States, expecting a war. I mean, we are basically left with nobody except Kuwait and the Gulf.
So the Saudis are positioning themselves, and they think that a war is coming, and they're signaling to the Iranians, we don't have a part of this, so don't retaliate against us.
Yeah, don't touch our oil fields, don't go after us, we have no part of this, we didn't want the United States in Iraq, we don't support them now. You see panic spreading across the Gulf. The Bush has decided to go in any case, no matter what his military says, no matter what our allies say. And there's certain evidence for that, and that's having two carriers in the Gulf at a time when the Iranians are reacting, or the Iranians are panicking, the Iranians are exhibiting paranoia. The last thing you want is more, Air Force in the Gulf.
Well, the third carrier group, the Nimitz, has just left San Diego, but that won't be there for 3 weeks.
Well, everybody's expecting this to come in the spring or early summer, this attack.
Meaning what? Any time in the next few weeks?
You know, if we have three carrier groups in the Gulf, and they can barely fit three carrier groups, I would pretty much expect a war.
So would that mean that when the Nimitz arrives in 3 weeks' time, that's when you figure they're going to pull the trigger?
I think what they're going to wait for is an Iranian provocation of some sort, or Iranian retaliation. The Iranians say, and I'm not sure this is true, but there was, Time.com has an article up on its site now saying there was a confrontation last September. The Iranians say these confrontations are happening every day. The United States, U.S. troops are probing Iranian lines. And this is in addition to the Iranian suspicion that we are funding and arming Iranian opposition groups.
Particularly that those in Balochistan that attacked the...
In Balochistan, they attacked, I think 20 Iranians were killed. Officer of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps was executed. These people are Salafis coming out of Balochistan close to bin Laden. But they still, it doesn't really matter whether it's true or not. The Iranian perception is the United States is pushing on its borders. And the Iranians will push back. They are not going to raise a white flag, as we've seen with the 15 British hostages.
Right. Well, clearly we're in a situation now where the British and the Iranians are talking past each other, and the Iranians have definitely upped the ante because now they've told the Iranian people on television what about this situation. They kept it quiet, and perhaps because of the New Year period, but the long and the short of it is now they've stirred up their radical base, and there was a demonstration in front of the British embassy. So,
you have to remember that hostage taking has worked for Iran. They were behind the hostage taking in Lebanon in 1982. They drove the United States and Britain out of Lebanon. In 1979, they took the American embassy. We were forced out of that half of the Gulf. They got their way. Hostage taking works for them.
But I think you're right, though, Robert Baer, in suggesting that President Bush draws a line there. I mean, there's been a feeling that, going back to 79, that, as you just said, they've been getting away with it. There's an equal feeling over here in certain circles with the neocons, etc., that it's time to teach them a lesson.
Absolutely. It's time to we should have done this in 79. It was Carter's fault if Carter hadn't taught him a lesson. Or if he had taught him a lesson back in 79, we wouldn't be facing this problem. Let's step up and take care of it right now. Which, of course, is crazy because our army would break in a serious war with Iran. We just don't have enough troops. Most we can do right now is bomb a couple bases, maybe some oil facilities, which my take on Iran, I'll just stir them up more.
Well, back in 88, there was Operation Praying Mantis, where the U.S. Navy did get into a major action. They sunk Iranian warships, a lot of small boats, and oil platforms were also destroyed. Apparently, what happened there was that the Iranian Revolutionary Guards were running out in speedboats and dropping mines into the Gulf, and the Iranian Navy were trying to retrieve the mines, and we blew up the Iranian Navy.
and let's don't forget what happened in 1988, is we shot down the Airbus and Iran
in that same period, right? Yeah,
by blowing up an American airplane. Now I know Libya was convicted for that, but there was an Iranian hand in that. But this, what the lesson here is that a conflict with Iran can get out of hand very quickly.
So, do you, judging by Margaret Beckett, the British Foreign Minister, and her measured response before the European Union, you get the feeling that the British are being, even though Blair has exhibited irritation, that they're behaving cautiously.
Tony Blair is a bit more of an empiricist than George Bush. He knows he can't sacrifice 6,000 or 7,000 troops in Basra, which is what would happen in a war with Iran. Bush, on the other hand, is saying, you know, we have to take out this evil entity and take it out now. And that is the depth of thinking at the White House.
And so the fact that the president is isolated, that the Congress is now moving to take over foreign policy, they've effectively, Nancy Pelosi has said, you have blown it, you're not, you can't handle it, in effect. And she's visiting Syria, and he's protesting that, suggesting that she's usurping his authority. She's saying, no, I'm just fulfilling the mandate of the Baker-Hamilton Commission. So there's you feel like the president is finally being challenged, not just by an equal branch of government, but by a Congress that's saying, or at least a majority of Congress that's saying, we've lost faith in your stewardship of national security.
Oh, I mean, I think almost everybody in the country has. But that's why Bush needs a provocation. He needs the Iranians to do something. Remember, he was going to start the war with Iraq in 2003 with a provocation. He was hoping that Saddam would shoot down a UN airplane. Even at one point, he talked to the CIA about the CIA's blowing up a ferry, an Iraqi ferry, which we would then blame on Saddam and go after Saddam at that point. So this certainly is in his mind. You know, look, if he was serious about calming things down with Iran, he wouldn't have those two carriers in the Gulf. He would have some sort of border commission with the Iranians to make sure there were no violations. There's a lot of ways to do this to avoid a confrontation, and he's not doing it, which tells me he wouldn't mind a dust-up right now.
And unfortunately, because of this sort of martyrdom and this weird sort of masochism and this belief that the West has been out to destroy the Islamic Revolution in Iran, they seem to be obliging.
Oh, absolutely. But he, see, the people that he has at the National Security Council, many of whom I know Iran. They don't necessarily agree with the policy, but they're telling him, you know, if you want to get the Iranians stirred up, here's how you do it. And that seems to be what we're doing in Iraq. And remember, we've got also in Afghanistan. I mean, the Iranians, no wonder they're paranoid. We've got two armies on their western and eastern borders. And, you know, Turkey is more or less with us. We've got the fleet in the Gulf. And this is the nature of the Iranians. This is the way they behave and the way they react. And they were this vulnerable in 1979, or they thought they were, and that's why they took over our embassy.
Well, in this case, though, you're suggesting that we're going to be very, very isolated. This idea that Cy Hirsch has been talking about, that the Shia are trying to organize and finance a counterweight against the so-called Shia, the Sunni, against the Shia crescent, the Saudis, the Jordanians, and others, and citing examples in Lebanon, for example. But if the Saudis are now saying, we don't want a part of this, and the Gulf states are saying, we don't want a part of it, if it happens, then we are going to be terribly isolated. And when you talk about Afghanistan, of course, the other shoe hasn't dropped there yet. The spring offensive from the Taliban is everybody's anticipating that. And, you know, there's a Shia-Sunni split. If there's ever a Shia-Sunni split, obviously there's one in Iraq, but there's also one in Pakistan. So Pakistan we could see some unrest in Pakistan, couldn't we?
Across the Middle East. I mean, this is just amazing about this administration. It managed to go to war with 1.2 billion Muslims all at once.
So you're pretty pessimistic then. I mean,
well, if that third carrier shows up in the Gulf and stays there and no one does anything to try to calm this down, and we could do a lot, I'm going to remain pessimistic, yes.
I see. Well, I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles, Robert Baer. We'll just have to stay tuned here, but as you pointed...
Let's hope I'm wrong.
Yeah, well...
I like being wrong.
Yeah, but in this case, the point that you're making is that this is almost a gift, the Iranian...
Yeah, we did this on purpose the 11th of January when we took the five IRGC members in Erbil, done intentionally with the plan of provoking the Iranians. Those guys, I used to run into them in Erbil in the 90s. They've been there since 1991, since the first Gulf War. Now, they're probably up to no good, as they would be. But the fact that we held them, have not charged them with a crime, and have not returned them to Iran is a clear, clear provocation against the Iranians.
Well, we
the
also
only explanation is that we hope they're going to react.
We're also apparently not holding, but we've managed to get a high IRGC guy, a Revolutionary Guard Corps. I think he was a deputy defense minister, wasn't he?
He was Deputy Oskari. He was deputy defense minister. And the fact that somebody's holding him, somebody's debriefing, is just fueling the Iranian paranoia.
Right. Well, thank you very much for joining us, Robert Baer.
Thanks, Ian. Bye.
Bye. And hello again, I'm Ian Marshall. Just speaking there, Robert Baer, who's the ex-CIA operations officer who conducted the Iraqi opposition between the two wars, and he targeted the Hezbollah and the IRGC, the Iranian Guards Corps, who are Revolutionary Guards Corps, who have grabbed the British sailors and Marines. He also writes a column for Time.com and has written two books, Sleeping with the Devil, How Washington Sold Our Soul for Saudi Crude, and Blow the House Down. And he was the character that George Clooney played in the movie, recent movie, Syriana. Let's now go to the subject of a broader look at our geopolitics, following on from Bob Baer's rather alarming analysis. I'm speaking with Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, who was Secretary of State Colin Powell's Chief of Staff at the Department of State from August 2002 to January 2005. He is now the Pamela Harriman Visiting Professor of Government at William & Mary. And the President was asked on Saturday about the British Marines and sailors captured in Iraqi waters by the Iranian National Guard, and he demanded their release, as of course have the British. He did not answer the second part of the question, which was, if Americans had been taken, what would you have done? What would you do? Do you feel that, in a curious way, the Iranians have provided us with, or the Bush administration with, a casus belli?
No, I don't. After all, we had the Iranians in 1979, 1980, for I believe it was 444 days, holding against all the Vienna conventions, against international law, our diplomats in their capital city. And though we did try a limited surgical military operation, it failed miserably, as you will recall. And I just don't think this comes to the point where you contemplate military action. I think you talk and you get beyond the rhetoric. You discover a way to save face for the Iranians, and you get your people back. Certainly not a reason to go to war.
But there does appear to be on the Iranian side a kind of almost masochism in terms of their feeling beleaguered. If you had to believe what Ahmadinejad said, that the reason he didn't come to the UN was because he thought he was expecting an attack at any moment. And here we have in the United States, in our press, speculation that we do plan to attack Iran. So I imagine from the Iranians' point of view, those kind of reports really do raise their temperature.
Well, I like to put it this way. In both Tehran and Washington, in both our presidents and the advisors surrounding them immediately, there's not a lot of brain power. There's a real problem in that situation because Ahmadinejad, though a feckless individual in terms of the presidency in Tehran, which is not a very powerful position, nonetheless does have some very dangerous alliances with people that don't necessarily respond to the real power, the real leadership in Tehran. And, of course, I refer to the Revolutionary Guards. So that's dangerous. It's very dangerous. It's equally dangerous, in my view, in Washington because we have a leadership that's not steeped in good decision-making. In fact, I would be hard-pressed to find a major national security decision that Washington has made in the last 6 years that makes a whole lot of sense. So I am worried, yes, I am worried that the lack of brain power in both capitals and the lack of negotiating skills in both capitals and the political will to use those skills in both capitals is a dangerous situation.
But Colonel Wilkinson, I'm sure there are people in the audience who will say, you are indicting the last 6 years of U.S. foreign policy, and you are the right-hand man to the Secretary of State.
Well, I'm not indicting his damage control. What he did was damage control.
I see.
That's a good summary, two-word summary of what he did. I tell some of my audiences in this country, you would not like to have seen the first 4 years without Colin Powell.
And clearly we're learning all kinds of ways that Cheney and Rumsfeld and even Rice did end runs around him. I understand there's a new book out by Andrew Coburn that suggests that Rumsfeld visited the White House on any number of occasions secretly.
Yes, I don't doubt that at all. I've spoken of the cabal between him and Vice President Cheney. There's no doubt in my mind that it existed, and also there's no doubt in my mind that it steamrolled Dr. Rice more often than not. She was unable to stand up to that as National Security Advisor, as intimate with the President, or as an individual on her own. She simply couldn't stand up to that kind of steamroller.
So your boss, Colin Powell, is doing damage control. I take it she wasn't much help.
Well, on certain issues, she tried to help, and on some issues, she did, in fact, help. The U.S.-China relationship was a sound relationship throughout those 4 years, principally because Colin Powell and Dr. Rice stole a march on Rumsfeld and Cheney right after the F-10 EP-3 incident, where they collided and the EP-3, the U.S. EP-3, had to land on Hunan Island. From that moment on, Powell and Rice owned the U.S.-China relationship, which was probably the most strategic relationship we have, so that was good. But on other things, like the U.S.-German relationship, the U.S.-French relationship, in fact, transatlantic relations in general, Colin Powell had to do enormous after-hours work, so to speak, just to keep relations on an even keel.
Well, I think in the incident you cited with the Orion colliding with the Chinese fighters, initially it seems like, again, your boss Colin Powell had to do damage control, because I recall at the time that the president and the vice president made inflammatory statements, which normally those things are handled by the defense attaché at the embassy. You keep it at a low level rather than call out the other guy.
Exactly. I remember those moments vividly, and I also remember how it ended. It ended with Powell having effected a reasonable agreement, our soldiers returned home, and Donald Rumsfeld sending a second lieutenant, as I recall, which was not quite in protocol with the Chinese, to retrieve his airplane, so the Chinese chopped it up in little pieces and FedExed it back to Donald. Well, that's the result of that kind of feckless
hubris,
diplomacy.
Right. Well, give us a sense then of where we are now, because we're told that there's a little bit more professionalism coming from Bob Gates having replaced Donald Rumsfeld, and that to some extent Condoleezza Rice is given some leeway to try and do the impossible, which President Bush assiduously avoided, which is to make a deal between the Palestinians and the Israelis.
I think you're right. I think Rumsfeld's departure from the administration, Gates' arrival, Bob Joseph's departure from the administration, protesting the six-party talks all the way out the door, Scooter Libby's indictment and the verdict in his trial and so forth has taken a lot of power away from the vice president. I think his power has been diminished markedly.
And Bolton too, I guess.
And Bolton too, yes.
Yeah.
But that said, there's been such a rough road paved for Dr. Rice that she now has to travel down. Even with the president's support in going down that road, I think it's going to be an extremely difficult task for her to just make up for past mistakes, let alone make some progress. And though I think she's got her aim on the right spots now, including the Israeli-Palestinian issue, including talking with the parties in the region who have the most interest in stability in Iraq, like Turkey, like Saudi Arabia, like Syria, like Iran, I think she's got her goals set right, and maybe even some of her strategies crafted correctly. But I just don't see that with all the errors that have been made in the past that I should be very optimistic about her being able to succeed.
And Colonel Wilkinson, now we have, of course, the House and Senate have passed different versions of an appropriations bill you know, one of these supplementals that have been funding these wars, and they've attached different time dates to get out of Iraq or begin withdrawing, and probably they'll settle on something around August or September in conference. But it seems the way that people are talking about, and particularly the Republican and Democratic spin people, you know, as you know, in Washington, the truth is a moving target, and whoever spins the truth the best wins the day, it seems. But cutting through all of that, it's pretty clear from the statements that Nancy Pelosi made is that she's saying that we have lost faith in our commander-in-chief and his policies, and somebody's got to step up to the plate.
Well, I don't disagree with that. I don't see the debate that's going on in Washington as quite as indicative of a split government as others might. I think some of the things that the Congress has done in a strategic sense are probably pretty important. They have sent an unmistakable signal to Nouri al-Maliki, to the Iraqi government in general, and to others that, and there are various strategic reasons, depending on who the others are, that our patience is not forever with regard to, for example, the Iraqis shouldering some of the burden, particularly the security burden. So that's not altogether a bad thing to happen. And I'm sure that if the president is thinking in his private moments, he understands that too. On the other hand, if we do come to a confrontation where the president has to veto legislation and send it back, and then perhaps even send some of his reluctant Republican colleagues back to their districts, back to their thinking processes, and he may lose some of them on the vote that comes up then we might be looking at some sort of a constitutional crisis. And we're not looking at a lame duck president, which we usually do about this time anyway, but we'd be looking at, as one of your writers said, I believe in The Guardian, a dead duck president. That's not good. We don't need an executive branch that is not only in the doldrums, which I'm hearing increasingly it is, but also in such a gray funk that it can't do anything. That's not a good situation. So I would hope that we work our way through this, sending strategic signals to those parties to whom we need to, but at the same time persevering and getting something positive done.
By the way, Colonel Wilkerson, I'm originally from Australia. So
oh, I'm sorry.
There's a little bit of tension between Australians and the British. You might be aware of. But I did get trained at the BBC, so. I'm grateful. So, and I'm definitely over here, and I'm, you know. So let me ask you though about this idea then that if we have a crisis and if we do indeed we have not just a lame duck, a dead duck, has this happened before in U.S. history where a Congress has had to step up to the plate and run the show?
Well, it certainly has in a very real sense with regard to what some would call similar circumstances, at least in terms of bad power management. Of course, I'm referring to the one time when we had a president who actually had to resign, Richard Nixon, during the Watergate crisis, and the articles of impeachment that were brought forward by the Congress in that event convinced the president and his lawyers that it would probably be best if he were to resign, because were impeachment to proceed, it would probably be successful, and he'd be removed from office and be the first president to do so. I guess he decided it would be better to be the first president to resign than to be the first president who is successfully removed from office through the process of impeachment. But the circumstances are somewhat similar in terms of the power that the president has. I think it's clear to most historians and scholars that Nixon had virtually no power at the heart of that crisis. And, in fact, most of the power was being wielded by his very powerful national security advisor / secretary of state. Unprecedented move in our history where a man assumed both positions. But Henry Kissinger did. He assumed both positions and was, in effect, the president of the United States.
And stayed on with the next administration.
Right.
Until
only to have, you may not remember this, only to have Gerald Ford become a little bit suspicious about this dual role and have Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld
exactly.
orchestrate Henry's, shall we say, diminution of power.
Right, and thus the split, in effect, between yes. the two strains of recent American foreign policy, the pragmatists or the realpolitik of Kissinger versus the neoconservative reckless utopianism of this new crowd, but I don't count them out. I mean, neocons.
And never underestimate your enemies.
And it seemed that they did have a very, very solid network of people inside the government. And you're starting to see that now with a lot of the Justice Department, if you could call it a scandal. I'm not sure it is, but the long and the short of it is, you've got these very junior ideological people who don't seem to have any qualifications but loyalty, wielding enormous power.
And that, I think, historians and people who pour into this are going to find was a major problem in post-invasion Iraq also, because they dominated Jerry Bremer's Coalition Provisional Authority.
Mm-hmm.
Same kind of people.
So, in other words, loyalty over competence.
Absolutely. Loyalty over competence, and even in that narrow wedge of competence they might have wielded, it was a very much ruthless neocon utopian vision that did things, for example, like, say, let's eliminate all the state-owned enterprises in Iraq tomorrow morning and let's privatize everything.
Hmm. Well, but I still see that delusion continuing, because you were mentioning earlier about it's time for Nouri al-Maliki to get his act together. It seems to me that he wouldn't be alive but for the protection of the Green Zone and the protection of the United States military. And so I just wonder what we really have over there. And when people like Senators McCain and Lieberman talk about how well things are going, and I notice a detect, perhaps I'm wrong, but I detect a certain strain in Senator McCain having hitched himself to the idea that this thing's going to work out. I don't see any evidence that there's much to work with there, and that they, you know, let's look at what just happened. This last month, 80 of our servicemen died, and over 600 Iraqis died in the last week alone.
I don't, I'm afraid I can't dispute what you're saying factually or theoretically. I share your concern. I particularly share your concern about Maliki and his government, because what I'm seeing now is I'm seeing various Shia elements line up. That is to say, from Muqtada al-Sadr to Skiri to Dawa to others that have their own militias, have their own power centers, they're lining up now because they are beginning to believe that the Sunni are going to, over time, be, by the surge in Baghdad and by other efforts that are taking place elsewhere, if not completely defeated, which I think is out of the question, but at least they're going to be pushed back a little bit. Maliki's sitting on $12 billion, I'm told, mostly of oil revenue, resources in the Iraqi government, which he's refusing to spend. So the Shia are looking right now at who's going to be in power, where that money's going to go, and who's going to be the guy on top of that power. And so you're going to start seeing these battles. You're already seeing them, of course, but you're going to see more of them, I think, more intense battles amongst the Shia, rather than just Shia, Sunni, or Al-Qaeda, Sunni, Shia, or all of them against the U.S. You're going to see Shia elements begin fighting each other in a more intense fashion, I think. And whether Maliki can survive that, even with U.S. still in the country, becomes a matter of concern.
And who would be vying for this $12 billion? Because the conventional wisdom is that al-Maliki's more beholden to Muqtada al-Sadr than he is to al-Hakim.
Well, that's the reason I have said in the past that if there is to be, and I'm not predicting this, but I'm saying if the scenario unfolds that a strong man comes back to Iraq, and that's the only way stability can come back to Iraq, I predict that strongman is going to be al-Sadr. And he's going to have different elements behind him, and the elements behind him may be the ones doing the real thinking, because I'm told he's not a rocket scientist. But nonetheless, he's got the name recognition, he's got the militias. One of my friends in Iraq told me yesterday in an email that his having departed may have done him some harm, because things are happening within the militia that he probably wouldn't want to happen were he there to supervise. I don't know if that's the case or not, but I suspect he can come back at any time and command a fairly good following of well-armed people.
But so, you mentioned earlier, Colonel Wilkerson, about the Shia, in effect, I guess you're paraphrasing you, what seems to be happening in Baghdad is ethnic cleansing. And I don't know whether you saw the front page story in the New York Times this week where an Iraqi woman had returned to her home. She was a Sunni. She'd actually gone to Syria as a refugee, and then heard that because of the surge and because the United States had come back into her neighborhood and set up a police post with some Kurdish Peshmerga, she then came back, and then the Sunni guys came to evict her, and then she called the Americans in, and they grabbed these two guys, and then lo and behold, the next day she's shot in the head when she goes to the grocery store.
Right. No, it's not something I can empathize, I can sympathize, I can see why Petraeus is doing what he's doing, I can see the rationale behind it. I understand that it's far better strategy and tactics on the ground than were there before, but I hear what you're saying, I hear what my friends in Iraq are saying, military and civilian, and I just don't have much optimism about it working.
So if you mentioned that you didn't think that the Sunni would be defeated, but if they are driven into Al-Anbar, which appears to be their fate, and at least it seems like we're fighting four wars there. We're fighting against the Sunni, Baathists, we're fighting against Al-Qaeda, we're fighting, there's a civil war, and then there's also the possibility of we're fighting against Iran, and then, of course, there's a possibility that it's already a surrogate war between the Gulf and Saudi and Jordan versus Iran, and there's even the more dire possibility of a regional war. So,
and you didn't mention there's some 80 to 100,000 thugs that are in the country doing nothing but making money off of all of this.
Right. And they unfortunately emerged a couple of days after the so-called victory on April
right.
the 10th. So, but is it possible that you have about a million plus, and the Iraqis are Baathists are in Jordan? That's where seems to be where they're fighting their war from. And I understand that the Baathists officers did have a long-standing relationship with the Jordanian army. Saudi money is apparently coming in. Is it possible that as the Sunni are pushed back, that you'll end up with a very volatile and perhaps destabilizing situation in that very small country of Jordan, population of 6 million? If you've got over a million angry Iraqi fighters trained fighting against the best military in the world, at the end of the day, where do you think they're going to turn?
Well, you've also got, of course, King Abdullah's also got this huge Palestinian population in Jordan.
Right.
And I have no doubt that he's worried about instability and destabilizing influences. I have no doubt also that Assad in Syria is worried about it. He's got close to a million Iraqis in his country, too. They might not be quite as gelled and have quite the objectives that you were just pointing out that those in Jordan might have. But nonetheless, it is destabilizing for them. There have been demarches, I think, from both countries to this country about that destabilization.
Hmm. Well, just in closing, what do you think Nancy Pelosi is going to be discussing with him? With Assad?
Assad?
Yeah.
Well, I hope she's talking to him about some pretty serious things. For example, I've gotten signals from Damascus that they're not that happy with being so profoundly in the embrace of the Persians. They are not, they realize that Iran carries a certain amount of magnetism simply because of the proximity, with only Iraq separating. But at the same time, they don't feel that comfortable being cheek and jowl with the Persians. They would prefer to have a little more flexibility, a little more resilience, a little more room to maneuver. And I think the firm feeling in the leadership in Damascus is that the reason they are where they are is because of us. because we won't give them any room to maneuver.
So, in other words, they're ripe for the picking if we show some creativity.
Well, I understand Dr. Rice and others' concern about going ahead with the UN investigation and into Rafiq Hariri's assassination.
Sure.
There's no doubt in my mind the Syrians probably did have something to do with it. But that can proceed anyway. As far as I know, last time I checked, it's proceeding.
Yeah.
That can be one issue. The other issue is profoundly more strategic. Do we want to force Syria into Iran's embrace with no choice of anywhere else to go? I don't think that's good, and I hope Nancy Pelosi will talk about that.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us. I could continue on here, but I know you've got things to do, and so do I. So, again, I appreciate your time, Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson.
Certainly. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking there with Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, who was Secretary of State Colin Powell's Chief of Staff at the State Department in the first 4 years of the Bush administration. He's now the Pamela Harriman Visiting Professor of Government at the William & Mary College. I'm now speaking with Max Blumenthal, who's a Prof and Foundation Writing Fellow at the Nation Institute. He writes for The Nation, Salon, American Prospect, and Washington Monthly. He was recently gained notoriety, having covered the CPAC, the Conservative Conference, in Washington, D.C. as a kind of guerrilla reporter, where he exposed the lunacy of the American right. And we'll expose a little more of that lunacy right now in terms of Monica Goodling, who was supposed to testify before this Senate and House Judiciary Committees. She was the liaison between the Attorney General Gonzalez and the White House, and she's taken the Fifth Amendment. It turns out she's a graduate of Messiah College, and she got a law degree at Pat Robertson's Regents University. So, Max, how much of the infrastructure of government has been already infiltrated by Pat Robertson's cadres of young Christian zealots who have been little to no competence, as we've seen from the testimony this week from Kyle Sampson, but are placed in extremely important jobs?
Yeah, well, I like everyone else, had never heard of Monica Goodling before this week. And when I started looking into her background, I realized that she was among 150 cadres of Pat Robertson's Regent University, graduates of this university, currently serving in the Bush administration. That's an enormous number, and I think this shows the long-term strategy of the Christian right, which is to wage the culture war from the inside. And, you know, after the midterm elections, when the Democrats took back Congress, a lot of people were pronouncing the death of the Christian right. They said, where are the so-called value voters? Well, I mean, this shows that the Christian right is you know, a force to be reckoned with. They're here to stay. And through, you know, Karl Rove's plan for a permanent Republican majority, this sort of Orwellian concept he's advancing, you know, he's leaned on these feeder schools where they train these, you know, eager young ideologues. He's leaned on them for people who are going to be loyal and carry out his program to basically not only purge government in general of people like you know, career professionals like Colonel Wilkerson, or you're just talking to, but also of Republicans like David Iglesias, the former U.S. attorney in New Mexico. And Monica Goodling played a really prominent role, more than anyone thought, in dismissing these attorneys. She was part of, she conducted all of the interviews in the Justice Department when they were deciding which U.S. attorneys they would purge. She met with Republican activists in New Mexico about, you know, the plan, the strategy for getting rid of David Iglesias, you know, at Karl Rove's direction, of course. Rove had singled out Iglesias because he refused to file these bogus voter fraud charges against Democrats.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know that basically these eight that were fired were targeted because they're in swing states. Rove has a plan for 08. He wanted to put in his people who would suppress the Democratic vote. And also, which is astounding that doesn't get more attention, the means by which he was able to oust these people, to get in his people, was through a loophole in the Patriot Act that was designed for a catastrophic situation like the Oklahoma bombing or Al-Qaeda cyber attack where you could replace U.S. attorneys. And now the Senate, Senate, of course, has closed that loophole. So
the most amazing thing about this, too, one of the most amazing aspects is that Goodling's first job after she got out of Regent was for Tim Griffin, Karl Rove's deputy, at the Republican National Committee. Now Tim Griffin has been installed as the U.S. attorney in eastern Arkansas to replace this other guy they purged, Bud Cummings. So, I mean, it's just incredible cronyism that goes all the way to the top.
But there is a plan here, which is to put their people in the U.S. Attorney's Office to use the law to manipulate the voting rolls.
Absolutely.
For 08.
Not only that, but also to protect Republican lawmakers who are under investigation for corruption. Paul Charlton, the U.S. attorney in Arizona, was investigating Rick Renzi, and I'm sure as all your listeners know, Carol Lam, the U.S. attorney in California, was investigating Duke Cunningham and all his...
Jerry Lewis, more importantly, the former head of the Appropriations, the most powerful seat in the Congress.
Right. I mean, that one hasn't gotten enough attention. But I mean, this is lawlessness, is what it is.
But with the righteousness of the Lord Jesus and all this fundamentalist zeal that they're doing the Lord's work.
Right. Well, it's completely ironic. You know, they teach that biblical law is foundational at Regent Law, and you know, of course, John Ashcroft is there teaching that right now. But Monica Goodling is now pleading the Fifth to avoid violating the Ninth Commandment. So it's pretty ironic.
Tell me about I saw your extraordinary trip to the CPAC, recent conservative conference, where you went in with a little handheld camera and interviewed a bunch of. Michelle Malkin did a meltdown. You know, David Horowitz went ballistic and projected all of the things that the hateful stuff that he stands for, blamed all of that stuff on the liberals. You got a question to that dreadful skinny woman that says outrageous stuff and promotes herself shamelessly. What's her name?
Ann Coulter,
yeah, you got a question to her about how can she, you know, that's when she called,
called John Edwards a faggot,
right? You know, which is of course the subtext for their whole idea Democrats aren't real men.
It was sort of another day at the office for me, as you know, I've been covering the right for like 4 years. But I never had a camera with me before, so people could never see what I was actually seeing, just how extreme it is, and also how unintentionally hilarious the whole spectacle they put on is. And what I wanted to do was either confront some of the, you know, prominent right-wing activists with the, you know, the premise of their work, or like what I did with Michelle Malkin, for instance. She's written this book in defense of internment, which, you know, defends using false information and baseless lies the internment policy of Japanese Americans during World War II, and says this policy should be implemented towards American Muslims today. And I asked her to sign a picture of the concentration camp Manzanar, where Japanese Americans were put in World War II. It's the premise of her book. Mm-hmm. And instead of just signing it or saying, yeah, this, you know, because her book says it was such a great place, she attacks me. Completely flips out hysterically and then runs away from her own book signing, leaving all these people in line. And she runs, of course, to Blogger Row, where all her right-wing blogger friends were. Mm-hmm. Attacks me on her blog. Ann Coulter, before 3,000 people, after she was, she had called John Edwards a faggot. I asked her about her book Godless, you know, where she adopts all the premises of the Christian right and positions herself as this sort of righteous moral leader. And I said, you know, Anne, I really appreciate your defense of marriage in your latest book. And can you explain, as such a proponent of the sanctity of marriage, why you have had 3 broken engagements and never been married? You know, I think she needs to be called out on this huge gulf between her private life and the position she takes in public, just like Ted Haggard and the rest of these complete frauds. Mm. And she, instead of responding to the question, of course, she insults me. Right. And cracks a few jokes. You know, the most hilarious thing of CPAC, along the lines of Republican hypocrisy, is I was talking, when I met David Horowitz, he introduced me to a guy named Corporal Matt Sanchez, who they had honored with the Gene Kirkpatrick Freedom Award for his confrontation with campus liberals. You know, he's a Marine, and he said these liberals on campus had called him a baby killer. It's a term, of course, no one has used since the 60s. And it turns out that this guy used to be a gay pornography star named Rod Majors that David Horowitz had introduced me to. I mean, it just doesn't get any weirder or more hilarious. And he was standing there while David Horowitz was attacking me, saying, you know, mumbling under his breath, liberals are so hateful, liberals are evil, you know, and this guy turns out to be a gay porn star.
Tell me about the chocolate Jesus.
Oh, well, this is another... example, I think, of the role that the Christian right continues to play in just as an insidious and influential force. You know, you have to look outside of politics a lot of the time to see the impact the Christian right makes. This is an exhibition in New York of a sculpture by a famous artist who likes to make sculptures and installations out of food, and it depicts Jesus Christ on the cross. He's nude. And this sort of apparently offended the Christian right. Apparently they've never been to the Sistine Chapel where Jesus is depicted nude there. Huh. But the Catholic League, this group which had gotten the Edwards bloggers fired, the bloggers of John Edwards fired.
Now this is Bill Donahue, but the truth of the matter is, it's what, him and two other guys, they call themselves the Catholic League?
Well, yeah, I mean. So anyway, the gallery buckled under pressure from the Catholic League, pulled this exhibit. The head of the gallery is threatening to resign. But who is the Catholic League? I just took a look at their 990 form. They have 4 paid employees. They have no constituency whatsoever. Mm. And Bill Donahue uses the whole thing. They have a $1 million budget, and he pays himself $350,000. That's like 1/4 of their budget goes to line this guy's pockets. And then you've got all these people running scared of this group. You've got the Edwards campaign terrified of them. And you've got, galleries freezing to show art, you know.
Right.
I mean, this is... So I think...
Let me just close here because we're running out of time. It looks like one of the guys you'd stalk, Dobson, who sees himself as a major kingmaker here, he's pushing hard for Newt Gingrich and trying to trash Thompson. I think Gingrich is going to step in late and let these other, the dwarves, duke it out and get nowhere. What do you think?
Yeah, no, I think that's a good point. And, you know, there's a desperation on the right for a real conservative candidate, and that's why Newt Gingrich went on Dobson's show and on bended knee and confessed that he had had all these affairs and left his wife because she wasn't pretty enough and she had cancer. And Dobson gave Gingrich his stamp of approval, even though Dobson himself has fired 2 of his co-hosts for getting divorced. One for having an affair and one for having a divorce. So his ethics are situational at best. And then, you know, Dobson goes out and says, gives an interview saying Fred Thompson, the actor who is threatening to get in the race and is polling really well, is not a real Christian, even though Fred Thompson was baptized in the Church of Christ. Dobson's spokesman clarified, "We only believe Christians are evangelicals." So, you know, you have to be an evangelical to be a Christian. And apparently Fred Thompson just hasn't had enough wives for Dobson. I don't know what the problem is.
Well, look, we've run out of time. I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles, Max Blumenthal.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Thank you. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. Just speaking there with Max Blumenthal, a Puffin Foundation writing fellow at The Nation magazine. His work appears in The Nation, Salon, American Prospect, and Washington Monthly. And you can look on I think it's still on The Nation website, at his video of the CPAC Conservative Conference. And I'd like to thank Louis Vandenberg, the producer, Rusty Wynn, the associate producer, Elliot Fon, the assistant producer, Melissa Figueroa, and Tamika Sogi for engineering today. This program is available at ianmasters.org, where you can contact me.